From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, my muck sidekick, Roger Mitchell. Rog, come in. The beauty of it is we don't need to ask where you are this week. That's we know where point. You are now and for the next month.
And for the next month, hopefully, that's all. Yeah, I'm on the lake, isn't it? I was just thinking, Grant, when we were dialing up there, you know, we had 2 weeks ago, we had a podcast where, you know, I said that the zeitgeist had come down a little bit and people were here, were kind of like recovering a little bit. And you said, nah, fucking lockdown.
Yeah, I've got to be honest, Roger. I was shaking my head and just thinking to myself, oh, bless him. When you told me that it was all going to blow over in a week.
So the latest news is that We can still travel. For example, you know, I have to go into my office every day in Switzerland, which is theoretically outside the red zone, and I will be allowed to do that. And people will be allowed to travel, but they just need to have a damn good excuse. So there will be spot checks and people will be asked, where are you going? Why are you going there? Is it necessary? Can you not do remote working? But so we can get out of the country, we just need to be armed with a good reason. But surely,
going to work is not a good reason.
Well, no, seriously.
I mean, otherwise everyone's going to use that reason, and then everybody can move about. So what's the point of the lockdown?
Well, I like everything here, the area in the middle of the grey is going to be so difficult to police. You know, I think they're basically putting out a statement of what I would call good civic duty, which is how you should behave to make sure we don't all collapse under this virus, and use your common sense and don't try and take any shortcuts. So if you've got something to do with work that isn't really necessary, like you need to deliver parts to somebody else that needs to send out an order, then move, by all means move. But if you're just going into the office to shoot the breeze and have a meeting and stay at your computer, then do it from home. That's what they're saying today. Like last night, this came out when, you know, it was leaked that this decree was going to be in place, and everybody panicked and everybody starting asking the questions. What about the haulage? What about trucks getting through Lombardy? What about the frontier workers? Like I said, the ones in Switzerland and the ones that work in France. And you've got some answers to some questions today, but it's not clear. And then, you know, day to day, you've got these rules now that, you know, you're very aware of, you know, the kind of like bar culture in Italy. Everybody goes to the bar for their breakfast. You can't be served at the counter anymore because that's seen as a place where the virus will live on the surface. So you can only be served at tables and you can't stay within 1 meter of anybody else, which is...
Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, it's the supermarket. We went to the supermarket today, full of stuff, but we arrived there. They gave us gloves to put on as we arrived. And that 1 meter distance had to be observed even when you were picking up your coffee, as the person before you was as well. You had to kind of like at passport control a little bit, you know, like stay behind the yellow line until the other person's left. Yeah. And then, of course, we had today, coming to sport, we had some of the Serie A games. We had Parma. Parma were playing, and the game was delayed for nearly an hour and a half because nobody was really sure what the government instructions were, you know, whether to play behind closed doors or whether to not play at all. And eventually it went ahead, but 90 minutes later or something like that. Mm. So we're in the middle of this, and you know, as I think we said before, the issue is, yes, you recover from this, But, you know, you recover from it because up till now, there's been enough beds to treat people, you know, and that's why the fatality rate is probably quite low, because they're getting great hospital care, all of them. And the Italian service here has been really quite excellent, I have to say. But they're running out of beds, Grant, and they're telling you now, if you've got some of the symptoms, to you know, call a help number and get some advice, and you know, and they're basically saying stay at home unless you're in serious trouble. So they're concerned that it's the shortage of beds that means that it can't be treated, that means there'll be more fatalities, and all the other stuff is just trying to minimize the extrapolation of the infections. You know, my son works in one of these quant shops in London, you know, and they've got models, you know, these maths guys, and, you know, he tells me what they're doing and what they show these models. And the line is vertical, Grant. It's vertical.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that's kind of like my news from here. But I'm really keen to hear, especially because, you know, in your day job, there's a lot of people that are waiting for your newsletter to drop. I'm not sure if it's out yet.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it is. I published it earlier this week.
But I mean, seriously, apart from all of this stuff, you know, I can tell you that the effect on the economy here is dramatic at micro level. You know, and this was an economy that was already stretched to the limit in terms of indebtedness,
yeah.
Stretched to the limit in terms of no growth for the last 20 years. And something like this, I'm not sure how they're going to deal with this. Tell me what you're going to be talking about over the next couple of days, Grant, because there'll be a lot of people on a very serious note looking to you for some kind of guidance.
Well, I mean, look, as I've said every time I've written in the last few weeks, I'm not a virologist, so you know, I can offer some thoughts on what might happen to the economy and stuff, but you know, there are people far smarter than me, so I've stayed right away from talking about the virus and the medical impacts of it. But the impact on the economy is undeniable. I mean, this is a true disaster for a global economy that is already struggling. You know, Italy is a particular case in point, as you say. But the rest of the world isn't healthy. I mean, we've seen the Chinese economy is basically shut down for a month, and you know, the data is starting to come out now. And the charts are apocalyptic. You know, we're looking at the entire economy coming to a grinding halt. You know, what it means, Rog, is more of the same. You know, the entire global economy has not been healthy since 08, despite what people try and tell you. So this is a major problem, Rog. And I mean, I think, you know, Europe is going to be very, very tricky because of all the stability pacts and everything they've got there, which really preclude the Italians just going out and spending money. I mean, in fact, the government this week, I think, has called for a suspension of that stability pact so that they can just
for sure
turn the printing presses up. And look, it's very difficult to see how even the Germans can say no, because you know what's going to happen. This thing is going to land in Germany and Spain and France and all these other countries. So, you know, I suspect the printing presses are going to get turned on. In fact, my piece this week is called Get to the Chopper, which is the great quote from Arnold Schwarzenegger, and just talking about how quickly we're going to move towards helicopter money now, because these people are going to have to come out and do something. They can't do nothing. But unfortunately, the thing they're trying to combat, which is a virus, doesn't necessarily respond to buying bonds by the central bank. So they're going to have to do something. I think you're going to see massive relief for the tourism, leisure, hospitality, airlines. Then you're going to see relief for retail. I mean, in America alone, between hospitality and retail and leisure, there's 34 million people employed there. So when you look at Italy, the number of businesses that are
tourism
potentially going to go bankrupt. And Italy, I mean, the numbers are shocking. I mean, there's an organization called Cerved, which is an Italian rating agency. And they put out a report this week, Roger, that said 10% of Italian companies are in danger of bankruptcy if the hard scenario...
That seems low to me.
Well, if this COVID-19 plays out, it's 15% in things like tourism or luxury goods or manufacturing. And look, and it probably is low, but it's still a staggering number. And so, of course, something is going to have to be done. It will be an emergency package, and it's going to be a shitload of money, basically, that's going to be have to be thrown at this.
But let me understand something which I can't square, which is that the United States, you've got Donald, you know, playing it down, and for whatever reason is playing it down, whether...
I suspect that might cost him the election.
But apart from me, like... You've got some states and you've got some universities, you know, taking serious action, declaring states of emergency, winding the tape forward when there's going to need to be bailouts. How can he then go to Congress and say, you know, when I said there was nothing to worry about, I'm now asking for $2 trillion. How does he do that, Grant?
Well, I mean, very easily, Rog. I mean, very easily. What I suspect will happen is this thing will take off. I suspect this week we're going to see the numbers start really spiking in the United States because they're getting more testing kits in. You've already got half the states now have cases documented of COVID. So I think the number's going to spike this week. I suspect what will happen is that the cases will spike. Trump will find someone to blame for it. It won't be him, but it'll be the CDC or it'll be, you know, local governors. It'll be something.
Mike Pence.
But going to Congress and asking for money won't be the problem because there's no way the Congress can say no to it. Mm. So that's not an issue. It's not like they can play politics and say, we're not going to give you health. I mean, they'll obviously make political capital out of it and point out how wrong he was. You know, when he said, we've got 15 cases and that's soon going to go to zero. As soon as I heard him say that, I was like, you are out of your mind. And I do think this will cost him the election. I think this is going to come back and bite him really, really hard. But we won't know, obviously, until November. But I think this week, you are going to see America suddenly get enveloped in this. And I think it's going to be ugly. I mean, I went through Los Angeles airport 10 days ago and one person in 50 was wearing a mask. And, you know, Southern California doesn't really seem to be remotely concerned about this. But I was talking to a friend who lives in Seattle and he said that the entire city is basically deserted now. The airport's empty. Downtown is empty. People are just not going out. Which obviously for the economy is a disaster. So this thing is kind of a weird. It's a black swan in that no one saw it coming, but it's totally not a black swan in that we should expect pandemics. And there's been all kinds of research done saying that pandemics are going to be a big problem. But it's going to hit the economy incredibly hard, not just in Italy, but everywhere in the world. And this is something that it is materially going to affect everybody's lives. And I'm definitely not trying to be a panic monger in this stuff, but I think people have to be very realistic and understand just how big a deal this is from an economic standpoint. We don't know how quickly it's going to get under control. You know, I was living in Hong Kong during SARS, so I have very vivid memories of that. And this seems far more troublesome than SARS. It seems far more aggressive. And the reaction to it is obviously far more alarming. In Hong Kong, it felt kind of contained. And even though, you know, they shut the schools down for a week or so here or there, it wasn't the kind of stuff we're seeing now. It certainly wasn't global. It wasn't anywhere near being called a pandemic. This thing is something wholly different and wholly more troubling.
Yeah, Grant, but tell me one other aspect of this which is kind of lingering in the sidelines, might be related, might not be related. I'm really concerned that the oil price is, after this OPEC non-deal, is going to tank tomorrow, and that's going to put out all the shale companies. And, you know, I just think next week for all the markets are going to be biblical. And, you know, I'm just wondering if you feel the same way. Is it something you're telling your clients? What is it that, what are you expecting next week when the market's open?
I think this week could be brutal, which is why they'll have to move very quickly. The only question is, can they do enough to stop this because of the valuations things are at? I mean, this is going to start to be a correction. Now, for last week, Roger, for all the craziness, going on in markets last week, the S&P closed down 0.6% on the week. So we really ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, we saw a crazy couple of days up and down and the market couldn't make up its mind. But At this point, this market is going to go lower, and it's going to go a lot lower. And I think we've reached the point now where it's no longer buy the dip, it's sell the rallies. And if you get to that situation, it makes things very, very tricky, because the algos, all the machines that trade the stocks now will automatically jump in and sell rallies. It becomes very, very hard for this market to get off its knees. And last week we saw this emergency rate cut by the Fed, 50 basis points in between meetings. Market jumped straight up afterwards, as it is almost conditioned to do. But then if you look at the rest of that day, it just kept going down, ended up 3.5% lower. So that tells you that a rate cut ain't going to do it. Another rate cut ain't going to do it. They're going to have to move towards
the chopper,
outright monetization. The chopper, get to the chopper. Yeah. So it's this is a big deal. I mean, we've had a lot of false alarms over the last decade, and they've all been kind of patched up by more quantitative easing and more rate cuts. But with the ECB in negative territory, we've already had Australia cut, we've had Canada cut, and neither of those two countries are really badly affected yet by coronavirus. We've had the US cut. Things are going to have to happen, and they're going to have to happen fast, because the virus is going to happen fast. So, yeah, buckle up this week, Roger, I think. Well, mind you, by the time this goes out, it's going to be Thursday. So I hope you were buckled up for the last few days. How's that?
Yeah, this is on Sunday night. But the reason I wanted to let people hear your view on this is because I've been following yourself, Grant, and your publication, Things That Make You Go, for best part of 10 years now. And in a market where everybody's conditioned to simply things going up easily and the Fed put and everything like that, it's been advice that most people have ignored. I tend to think your moment has arrived, young man.
Well, I mean, I don't think of it as a moment. I mean, I hope it hasn't, Rog, because if I'm right about what I think is going to happen, it's going to be, the worst kind of right you could ever want. So, in many ways, I hope I'm wrong, but all the signs are that, as you say, I think we could be entering a very difficult phase. And if myself and a lot of very, very smart guys that I listen to are right, then what could happen if they don't get this under control will make 2008 look like a fun time. So
yeah,
this is serious, and people, the same way when we had the virus occur, people were talking very early about, look, you need to take this seriously. The same goes for the economic stuff. People have to take this seriously, because this is not something that's going to be fixed. I mean, still the press are talking about, this could be a great buying opportunity. It will be. It will be a great buying opportunity, but it ain't going to be this week. That is for damn sure.
I'm not going to be catching any falling knife, I can tell you that, Grant.
No, you're a wise man.
So listen, that's a good segue to who we're getting on to the show today, who comes from the world that we're talking about. He comes from the big banks, Goldman and Morgan Stanley, and he's taken that expertise into the world of sport and sport finance and sport M&A, advisory, capital raising. You know, we often talk on the podcast about new capital coming into sport, changing the way things operate, changing governance. We'll talk about all of those things, and we'll be able to do that in the context of his background as a fan of Inter Milan, but also as somebody who has set up an advisory company called Tifosi, which he set up with Gianluca Vialli, the footballer, to offer retail investors, or fans, if you want to call them that, the ability to invest in their clubs through a variety of financial instruments, whether they are bonds, convertible notes, or things like that. So in the world that we are talking about, his business itself will have an impact on all the things that we've just discussed. So I'm really looking forward to the discussion with Fausto.
Hello.
Hi, Fausto.
Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. You never know you were Italian. Your English is perfect, man.
I grew up abroad.
let me introduce you to my partner here, Grant Williams.
Fausto, hi.
Hi, Grant. How are you doing?
Great. Lovely to have you with us. Thanks for coming on.
Excellent. My pleasure.
Fausto, just before you came on, we had our little intro, which today was less jokey than normal, and we were talking about the coronavirus. And obviously, I'm based in Lombardy as a Brit, and you're an Italian based in London. Tell us from your viewpoint how you see all this panning out for your country, for how it then knocks on, and then for your business. Let's start there, mate.
Yeah, it's obviously a very unfortunate situation. I think it will get worse before it gets better, and we have a real grasp on what's going on, and then slowly, hopefully, getting control of the situation as well. You know, just shows how connected we are and how fast things like this can travel. So I think, you know, specifically on the Italian reaction to it, obviously there is a strong link between Italy and China, which might have had an impact on, you know, kind of aggravating the situation in Italy, and being the first country that where it was clear that you know, this virus was definitely going to have quite a significant impact. So I think the reaction from the government has been strong. Yep. My view is that you know, because in these things, you know, there is kind of a public health element, but also a PR element to it. And I think clearly they looked at it, okay, this is serious, so we have to react, and let's listen to people that are smarter than us. So I think from that point of view, it was very good. I think on the PR side as well, I think they clearly didn't want to be seen as kind of the stereotypical, slow-reacting, you know, laissez-faire Italian you know, that might have dented the public image of the country as well, because this is global and this is spreading very fast. So the country definitely wants to be seen as taking a very proactive role here. So that's a little bit my view from the outside. I have no doubt that this will spread from what I read. I'm obviously not an expert, so who am I to kind of give an opinion on this, but you know, like, we are preparing for it also in London. You see it clearly. Businesses here are taking measures. A lot of the, you know, large financial institutions, corporates, but only companies like us, where, you know, there's only 15 people, we are taking preventive measures as well. Because there is business disruption already going on, and probably it's going to get worse.
Fausto, tell me a little bit on that. You know, talking about your business, you were working for one of the very, very biggest banks as a head of advisory for sport and media and entertainment, and then you set up your own company, Tifosi, with Gianluca Vialli. Tell us a little bit about why you did that, jumping from what was clearly, you know, a very, very strong job you had, a very interesting job, and you decided to become an entrepreneur in an area where people say sport and finance don't mix. Tell us about why Tifosi, and what was your vision and what it is now?
Yeah, I think passion had probably a lot to do with it, which often leads to irrational decisions. You know, it's not completely irrational, but definitely there was a strong personal emotional element to my choices, you know, like 4 or 5 years ago. So from where I was sitting, within a big investment bank doing, you know, M&A and capital raising advisory for large corporates within, you know, the TMT space, kind of focusing specifically on media and technology, kind of really sitting at the crossroads between kind of the old media models, I mean, broadcast content production, you know, sports rights, and then how that crosses into more, you know, novel business models. I mean, streaming or online investing, et cetera, et cetera. So I saw that sports was an area that was undercovered by the big banks. I saw that, you know, the business model, especially back then, of predominantly football clubs, you know, didn't really lend itself very well to a classic investment banking model, because, I mean, you deal with corporates that are, you know, most of the time tens of billions. I mean, the biggest football club, I mean, let's call it Real Madrid, it's maybe worth, I don't know, 4 billion, 5 billion, yep, maybe, if you stretch it. So it's still a relatively small client of a big investment bank. And so, but you have a wide spectrum of all these clubs that need financing. And to do that within a big bank is quite difficult because, you know, the cash flow profiles of these clubs are quite complex, right? Because there's so many inputs and outputs, you know, in terms of broadcasting rights, player transfers, loans. I mean, there's very specific rules. I mean, financial fair play, every country is different. So if you then are within a big bank and you need to present opportunities to your investment committees, you know, most of the times they don't go very far, right? And that's ignoring any type of, you know, franchise issues that that there might be, some owners that might not pass KYC or conflicts. Yeah. So, you know, so it's quite difficult in order to do that. Nonetheless, I did a number of transactions, but it's very hard. It's a little bit better now, obviously, given sports is becoming an asset class. But still, within a big financial institution, you know, doing sports financing, you know, you might be focusing on, you know, the top 10, maybe 20 clubs. But below that, it's almost impossible because you got to focus on bigger clients. And given I have a strong affinity for the sport, obviously, you know, a passion for it. And, you know, I gotten to know Gianluca Vialli quite well over the years. He became a friend, and we decided to do something more entrepreneurial and try to connect these issuers of capital, these football clubs, with people that wanted to invest into sports. And so that's kind of how Tifosi was born. Kind of seeing an underserved market, seeing clubs that need capital, that need real advisory, putting them in touch with investors, which might be, you know, through our, because one side of our business is our investment platform, which is, you know, obviously connecting these investors online. The other part is, you know, tying them to more sophisticated investors.
Fausto, let me just take you back to something you said at the very beginning there, and that is you talked about passion, this being a passion of yours, and this is something that I'm always fascinated about. This the place for passion in sport is obvious. The place for passion in business is normally an absolute disaster. Mm-hmm. And you know, every time I think you bring passion into the world of business, to a certain degree, it's great from an inspirational point of view. But you know, as you alluded to, making decisions based on passion is the antithesis of what business is all about. And mm-hmm. you know, the few times I've spoken to people, my friend Jim Pilotta, who ended up buying Roma, you know, I spoke to him when he was in the process of completing that purchase, and you know, he was a businessman with no real love of soccer. He's since come to absolutely love the game, but he went into it with a cold, clear business plan, and obviously that's a problem for a lot of the fans unless the team's doing well. How do you juggle the passion that the fans have with the cool detachment that you need as a businessman and try and find the right balance? Because to me, it's such a poison chalice.
Yes, I think there is an inherent contradiction almost, because fans will always try to push you to acquire very expensive players. I mean, I'm simplifying it a little bit, but if you go on social media, if you read a lot of the commentary in the newspapers, there is a lot about that. You know, you can fix everything by buying stuff, and the owners, which have unlimited capital in the eyes of the fans, need to make that happen. And if you don't, then obviously there's going to be repercussions for the owners online, and in some instances it leads kind of to more aggressive displays of discontent. So I think it comes down a lot to communication and following league rules. I think financial fair play, has helped the leagues to become more more profitable, right? Over the last 5-6 years, there has been an improvement of around $1.5 billion in reduction of losses, actually making profits across the leagues, which have helped. And these are quite strict rules, as some clubs are realizing now. And that is attracting, obviously, more sophisticated capital, because if people keep making losses and clubs will keep falling over, obviously, you're only going to attract a passionate type of capital, your Morattis or your Berlusconis, that have used these clubs more as social vehicles than as engines to make money. And if you look at the US model, people have made a lot of money, right? If you look at the multiple expansion of NFL franchises, NBA franchises over the last 30 years, and the equity accretion that has been created for those owners, it's been absolutely amazing. And I think a lot of those owners, including Jim Palotta, or some of the US owners you always also see in the Premier League, but quite frankly also now in Italy, they have seen value, because these franchises, they perhaps trade at 2 to 3 times, whereas in the US you have to pay 6 to 8 times for that. So they see room for growth, but it will take time, it will take rules, it will take probably friction between some of the clubs, between the leagues and the clubs, figuring out what is the right permutation in order to organize all these calendars, these games. And I think then the fans or the public needs to realize that the game also has changed. Right, the stakes are higher. A club 20 years ago, you could top club, you could probably buy it for 50 to 100 million. Now that's 100x. Right, so the stakes are higher. If you own a business worth a couple of billion, you need to manage it differently, and you need to put people at the helm of those clubs that are actually capable. And any company needs to live within its means. So, kind of keep spending, without any boundaries. I think those days are over, and I think slowly the fan will need to, come to the realization that it's just different than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, Fausto, you talked there about the example in the US and the massive value accretion we've seen in the franchise over there. But of course, they have the draft system, which does, I think, a fantastic job of making sure that every team has a chance to not just be perennial losers, apart from the Cleveland Browns. Apologies to Cleveland Browns fans listening. But at least you get this rebalance where the franchise values all kind of get lifted up together, because we've had the Patriots dominate NFL for a long time now, but their time will go, and the teams who are poorer will get the good players. That to me seems like a great idea from a business point of view, in terms of making sure that there's some kind of parity between franchise values. But obviously that's never going to happen in in soccer unless we get a draft system, which I just can't see happening. Is there any way that the smaller clubs, apart from striking it lucky and finding a whole bunch of talented players that come out of nowhere, sort of the Dortmund model that Roger looks at, is there any way that the smaller clubs can ever compete on a level playing field, or are we going to see this separation just continue to get further and further apart?
I mean, you see it happening real time, kind of that friction in the market, right? I think the US system with the drafts, I mean, it's not going to happen in Europe because it's tied to the colleges, and you know, in Europe, you know, talent gets spotted at 8-10 years old. You know, education in a way goes out the window, and people kind of pursue their passion, you know, and kind of giving up their education often. So it's very difficult to tie that to some kind of education system and then making a draft from that. So kind of like the talent recruitment model is very, very different. It's also one of the reasons why, you know, U.S. soccer or soccer clubs, not the national team, but U.S. soccer can never compete in the near term with European football or South American football, because they just don't have that talent pool from a very, very young age. So it's a very differentiating factor for Europe, but also one that's creating inequality. And it's not just, I would say, the talent, but also the system of relegation and promotion, which is encouraging a lot of spending, obviously, which is what financial fair play is trying to avoid. But it's obviously still there because, you know, there's a high correlation between spending on salaries and, I mean, to a lesser extent, spending on transfers, but there's a high correlation between spending and performance. So that's what makes it quite difficult. If you put on top of that the cultural differences of the different leagues, it makes it very hard to create a uniform league like you have in the US, where you've got 350 million people all speaking the same language, playing by the same rules, no relegation, promotion, plus a draft system. So you're absolutely right, it's very different. However, I think given that at the end of the day, money talks, and these top franchises are extremely valuable, and some of these mid-level teams want to make the jump to those top teams, you're going to have a reconfiguration of that ecosystem, right? Where, you know, there's different proposals on the tables, the FIFA model, which is more global, or the UEFA model, which is more European-centric. Obviously, the national leagues are trying to maintain their importance, but it's clear that you will have a strong push towards a more closed franchise model, which is going to be more centralized, which is going to give, you know, clubs more predictability in terms of their cash flows. And then I think you're going to have a group of clubs that perhaps are going to be in between, that are still going to make money, have potentially access to the club, top clubs. But then you're going to have a group of clubs, I think, that are just going to be too small. They're going to be regional. They're going to be locally supported, I feel. And they're just going to have to rethink their business models, because they just will not have access to, you know, the big prize money. And they will need to, you know, think differently. And they say, like, look, we are more of a community-driven club, and that's absolutely cool. And we are more like a, you know, like an indie movie producer. We're not going to compete with Marvel. And that's fine, you know.
Yeah, Fausto, a lot of the things you're saying there are things that we've talked about before, the Hollywood versus art house thing. And I guess I would suggest I get this more than anybody, the what I call the inevitability of polarization. However, Fausto, however, I have to say this to you. Andrea Agnelli saying he doesn't think Atalanta should be there, that's just not going to go down with all of us as sports fans. You know, when we've got our business hat on and we're removing volatility so that capital can get a return, yeah, we can get comfortable with that because that's our world. But the day that a team like Atalanta, because they are excellent in everything they do, get to the Champions League probably last eight, and Agnelli says, I don't think that's right, surely that's a bridge too far, Fausto.
Yeah, no, I'm not echoing anything that Andrea said. I mean, my personal view is more on a general basis. I'm not excluding Atalanta. I mean, the Precassi family has done an amazing job and they're getting rewarded for it. And, you know, they are now, you know, part of Italy's elite and in Europe, you know, elite as well. And looks like next year they probably, I mean, depending obviously what's going to happen, might participate again. So they will, you know, definitely be part of a club. If it's the top 20 club, top 40 club, I don't know, right? I don't think Agnelli is deciding that as a single person, right? So it's probably one man's opinion, the same as many other people will have an opinion. So, you know, this discussion is not something that's going to, in my view, is over. It's not going to be decided next year or the year after. It will take a time, some time before people actually are going to settle on what it actually means. At some point, there will be a line in the sand, probably. Right. And maybe it's a dotted line where, you know, there is some kind of access for clubs that do well. You know, what I'm saying is that, you know, the current model is very difficult to maintain in the long run. It's just economically very hard, right? If you want to go, you know, talk to, you know, private equity firms or some investment banks. If you're a bigger club and you got to explain your business model and you want to finance a stadium for $500 million or, you know, get some a bond issue done for like $200-300 million, you know, if you don't have visibility on your cash flows, it's quite, you just can't get it done.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's impossible, right? And, you know, that's just reality. So
Fausto, that, you know, this is my conundrum, because I guess I was talking about this maybe 20 years ago, because I was part of one of the leagues that weren't in the cool kids club, you know, a small league. And, you know, the big teams in the small leagues, I would suggest, have been the huge losers of this, these two decades of moving towards this model. Now, I agree that the status quo can't work. I just don't know how we get to something that does work, that's acceptable. I think what you say is correct. You're going to have Hollywood clubs that are going to be in some kind of like high-end premium entertainment type market, lifestyle brands, all of that. You're going to have community clubs like, you know, we've had two on this podcast. We've had Aberdeen. And we've had Plymouth, who are understanding that they need to make their business work around their community and spin those revenues like that. It's the ones in the middle that I think are going to struggle a little bit and try and be, they'll be in a little bit of a no man's land. They'll take risks and probably their cash flows won't be stable. And one of those clubs is a club that I'd like to ask you about, Sampdoria. Now, Sampdoria is Gianluca's club. Sampdoria is, I think, I'm almost certainly, I can say this, one of the favourite clubs of British people following Italian football, because that was when Italian football exploded in the UK. You were involved in Gianluca and other investors trying to buy Sampdoria over the last year, 18 months. Give the listeners an idea of the kind of stuff that happens when serious money and serious people look to take over a club that is perhaps still operating under the old feudal type system.
I mean, it was obviously a bit of a clash of cultures between the, you know, the potential investors and you know, the current owner of the club. I mean, our investment thesis was that Sampdoria is a unique asset within Italian football, right? So you have the, you know, let's say the top five, six clubs in Italy, and then Sampdoria, just in terms of brand value, in terms of history, and in terms of also an opportunity to create a sustainable club that travels across boundaries, was quite a unique opportunity. So we saw a club that had done quite well from a player trading point of view, had, you know, acquired some great youngsters that then were sold to very big clubs. Icardi, Skriniar. I mean, it was many of those players. But it was a business model really reliant on player trading, which is something that's very Italian. But, you know, if you try to explain that to a U.S. investor, they attach a lower multiple to that because it's volatile. Yeah. Cash flows and you know, unless you really institutionalize that, like Atalanta is trying to do, or, you know, Ajax, or, you know, clubs that have been doing it for a very, very long time, it's very hard to put real value on that, right? So there was undoubtedly value. You know, the club had done very well, but it's very hard if you actually produce a model to, you know, plug in tens of millions going forward, right? So, you know, US investors, I mean, the ones that we were working with at the time, definitely looked at the club as a franchise that could increase its brand value significantly, increase commercial revenues, build a new stadium, really, you know, could benefit from more data analytics. I mean, a lot of things that, you know, US and Premier League clubs have done to kind of try to bring that club to the next level. So, you know, we believed an opportunity was there. Unfortunately, we couldn't come to an agreement because, you know, if you're dealing with, a less sophisticated, owners on the other side, the discussion is just very, very complex. And we unfortunately had to withdraw from that process.
Fausto, how do you manage this? Because again, this is getting into the stuff that really fascinates me here in this kind of tug of war between the fan and the businessman. Because again, going back to Jim's experience with Roma, you know, I know how Jim went into that deal with exactly what you just said there. Here's a chance to take a great club that should be greater, take it to the next level, do all the right things, try and get a new stadium put in place, everything. I mean, the plan was there. Mm-hmm. It was a good plan, and it came from the right place. And yet his time there was incredibly volatile simply because of the performance of the team on the pitch. You know, we had one year they get to the semifinals of the Champions League and Jim's getting carried around shoulder high and can't put his hand in his pocket to buy a drink anywhere in Rome. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a couple of years later, the team's not doing so well and he's booed wherever he goes. Mm-hmm. How do you manage that? Because you're trying to do the right thing. You're trying to do something that's very positive for the club. You're doing it with the cold eyes of a businessman, but you must have a certain amount of desire in there to get the club somewhere. How do you manage the fickle nature of both the team's performance when, you know, one bad apple amongst the squad can ruin the dynamic of a team? Mm-hmm. How do you go from the boardroom down to the team level and try and get all the cylinders firing at the same time? Because it seems almost an impossible thing to pull off.
You need to localize your strategy. Right. And I mean, I work with Jim, and, you know, I did a private placement right after he acquired Roma when I was still at my previous bank. So I understand, you know, the complexities that he went through. I think that he probably underestimated, you know, the local dynamics I mean, Rome is a very, very difficult place to do business, right? I mean, it's not, you know, just saying I'm going to invest $1 billion and build a stadium that is going to make things happen. I mean, in the US, if you do that, you know, there's going to be a lot of, you know, cities that are going to, you know, give you incentives to come there, and, you know, you're going to get tax waivers, et cetera, et cetera. You can arbitrage that as a, as an owner. I mean, in Italy, it just doesn't work that way.
No. Right?
And, you know, and so in Rome in particular, which is the capital, and, you know, it's a city that's been doing politics for more than 2,000 years, you know, it's very, very hard. And so, I think that probably was the disconnect. So, you know, obviously with Sampdoria, we looked at it, you know, with a mixed strategy. There was obviously the, you know, the top-down, you know, U.S. strategy that we had translated in action items, but also we had the local element there. There was Gianluca Vialli, there was the Garone family that we had also involved. So we knew how we were going to play that mix of the U.S. strategy and kind of like the local dynamics in order not to get caught up in value destruction, right? And so my view is that, you know, managing a club remotely is very hard. You need to be involved. You need to know what's going on, especially in Italy, where there are a lot of, you know, very local dynamics and rivalries, and, you know, so you need to be able to manage that.
Fausto, I agree with you on the example of Roma, and you know, Grant and I have talked a little bit about what Jim maybe could have done better and what he misunderstood a little bit. But let's take us back up north to your own team, Inter Milan. Now, Inter Milan, I think last summer had quite a difficult decision to make regarding their manager. They could have gone for, who they eventually did go for, a manager who wins but is notoriously difficult to manage, who isn't necessarily a team player, who will kind of like use the fans to get more investment in his team, and he won't be what I would call playing with the board on a kind of like a common front. And I know from, you know, some of the people around Inter, I can't say who it is, but I know people on the Sunning side and the Lion Rock side, and, you know, sometimes Conte is a difficult pill to swallow. You know, you from both your financial background, but also as a fan of that club, tell us how you think your club being directed at the helm now by Antonio Conte is doing, and how it is likely to be sustainable.
I mean, I would say as a fan, I'm happy, not necessarily because of his Juventus past, but because he is clearly, you know, a strong individual leader, somebody that, you know, similar to Mourinho, can bring out a certain spirit and competitiveness out of the team. He can create a, you know, an us versus the rest of the world type of mentality. He can really, you know, kind of close ranks and motivate the team. I think that's a special skill. He's proven that in the past. Just think about, you know, the Euros couple of years ago, where Italy had a horrible team and still, you know, gave Germany run for their money in the semifinals. So you know, he's a very strong coach, right? I just don't think he probably understands, or he doesn't want to understand, the financial implications of his transfer activity, right? There are rules. I mean, Inter is navigating on a very thin line with financial fair play. You know, it cannot afford to do that because, you know, you need to be able to predict that you're going to participate. And being reliant on future player training in order to make that happen is very risky, right? So you need to have a more solid financial plan in place. And, you know, I think it all comes down to, you know, to leadership, to communication, just to ensure that everybody is on the same wavelength, right? I mean, you know, in any other company, you know, you probably would have a budget at the beginning of the year. These are our forecasts in terms of revenues, and this is what we can spend, right? And then you've got a CapEx budget, and that's it. If somebody during the year comes to you and says, I want to buy, you know, 1,000 computers because, you know, I think I need them, you're probably going to say, no, it's not in our budget, or, you know, you're going to see what you can do. You're just not going to agree to it just because that one person is going to say that that's what they want to do. So, you know, it's not a problem that's unique to Conte or Inter Milan. It's obviously across the industry. I think that the more clubs that will be disciplined, like Man City potentially, or AC Milan, or, you know, like, I don't know if it was Fenerbahce or Galatasaray a couple of years ago, the more these repercussions will, be very, very tangible for a lot of these clubs. And, you know, it just needs to be crystal clear that, okay, you need to be able to spend what you can afford. And, you know, at Inter, they're doing very well. I hope they will continue to do very well, obviously, as a fan. But, you know, internally, you know, the books need to balance.
Yeah. Yeah, let's change tack a little bit, because earlier in the interview you said something which I noted down. You said football is an asset class. And, you know, one of the things that people won't know that I'd really like them to know about is what Tifosi has done for what we referred to earlier as the community clubs. And I'm putting Norwich into that as well as Stevenage. Tell us a little bit about the kind of offerings that you're giving to the fans to allow them to invest directly into their football club, and how that's being received.
Yeah, so what we build is a sports investment platform. Which is, you know, very unique. It's the only one that's around. So we are regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. So we enable clubs to issue securities, bonds or equities or anything in between to an investor audience globally. So through our platform, investors can have access to, investment opportunities. They go through a very regulated process of investing that I won't bore you with, but it's kind of quite rigorous, and you adhere to the strictest standards of online investing. And for clubs, it means that they have access to more flexible ways of financing the club. So for a lot of the clubs that we work with, I mean, Norwich or, you know, Stevenage, which is one of our earlier ones, or even in Italy, Frosinone, Pescara, or a number of the other clubs that we are working with. I mean, they're raising sizes, you know, in the millions or sometimes tens of millions that are not really institutional sizes, right? And given their cash flow profile, even if they would have a discussion with more sophisticated investors, those terms would be very prohibitive, because, you know, they can't really offer, you know, a solid security package to those investors. So what we have created is a solution for those type of clubs where they can go directly to the consumer or the investor and offer them terms that still, for a retail investor audience or, you know, more sophisticated in, you know, kind of like high net worth audience, is very attractive. On the debt side, it's typically mid-single digit cash coupons complemented with club credit and a promotion bonus. And so for the retail investors, quite attractive, but also for the club, because you know, we offer them a real alternative that otherwise they wouldn't have. They would just resort to shareholder loans or very, very, we'd call it, quite ineffective ways of financing the club. So it's a real solution, and I think it works well with clubs where there is real trust between the ownership and the actual investor base or fan base. And you know, you can raise significant amounts of money. There is an implicit security within that trust, so that even if the actual financial instrument is unsecured or flexible, there's a strong incentive to pay the investor or the fan, because the last thing that you want to do is obviously default on your own clients. So it's a solution I think that's quite unique. It doesn't fit any club or clubs, but I would say for clubs that are kind of like right below kind of the top clubs, it could be an attractive solution. At the same time, it reinforces that link between the local community and the club and ownership.
Yeah, Fausto, this with the global nature of football these days, and the fact that that teams, even unlikely teams like my team Fulham, have fans all around the world. Mm-hmm. This is a tremendous opportunity for the clubs to tap into the passion of fans, because mm-hmm. Most fans, they want to feel like they're a part of their club, and if they can invest, even if it's not in a financial instrument, but if they can invest in their clubs in some way, whether it's $100 here or there for something, you have an incredible amount of cash sitting on the sidelines that, realistically speaking, as an investment professional, they're not even looking for a return. You know, they just mm-hmm. want to be a part of their club and contribute to it in some little way and feel like they are connected to the way and the future of the club's going. How mm-hmm. do you tap into that? I mean, obviously it's at odds with hardcore financial practices, but how do you find a way to tap into that? Because it's the perfect investment audience for you.
Yeah, I think that's what we are doing through these platform-based raises, because even if you offer mid-single digit cash coupon plus club credit and a promotion bonus, I mean, if you would remove the brand name from the offering, I mean, you probably wouldn't invest if this was kind of like a small industrial
right, exactly
company.
Right.
You just wouldn't do it, because you think probably that you would invest in the bond market or in another type of instrument. So I think these type of offerings, they are very suited to clubs that want to engage with their fans and kind of benefit from that strong direct link that's out there. And so we see it in the case of Norwich. I mean, we raised £5 million in 6 days. And so we surveyed every single investor. And, you know, the two key reasons for investing were, one, I want to support my club. And B, I think the return is attractive from a retail point of view. So if you can combine the two, I think you have a strong proposition. I think if you are going to weaken the financial returns, I think the amount of money you could raise is going to suffer from that. Or if the trust is not that strong and the fans are less willing to support the club, you obviously cannot raise that much money. But I think if a club is willing to tap into its fan base, offer them something that's attractive, and at the same time engage them for something real, which might be an infrastructure project, or giving them kind of like a real connectivity to something that will benefit the long-term future of the club, I think there's definitely something that could work.
Fausto, I'd like to probably reinforce that with a question. We've seen in the last month, never mind the last 30 years of reducing interest rates, the last month, the move towards negative interest rates. Now, surely, if I'm getting, I don't know what the coupon is at Norwich, but call it 7, 8, 9, I've no idea, with an institution that is unlikely to go bust. You know, it can happen in football, but, you know, it's, you know, surely that's a hell of a great deal, so much so that I'm wondering, has the price of the bond gone up in the last month as interest rates have come down?
Yeah, I mean, around 60% of sovereign debt in Europe has negative interest rates. So we're like in an extremely low interest rate environment. It's probably going to continue for a couple more years, especially now, you know, with central banks around the world that have taken some action. So yes, you know, it's a key reason why people have invested in these bonds, because they just look at their savings rate, which, you know, probably in the UK is going to be, you know, 1% at best, and they compare it to the Norwich bond, for example, where you can get 8%.
Right? Wow.
In the case, yeah. So, I mean, it's 5% in cash, and then 3% they could spend at the stadium, so which for a fan was real cash. And then in their case, obviously, they were very lucky, those investors, because the club got promoted and then they made a 25% bonus. So the proposition was quite interesting. So if you believe that ownership is trustworthy, right, in the case of Norwich, it was a strong bond between Delia Smith and one that's owned the club for, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years, I don't know, and the fans. You know, you look at that and say, okay, so that's, you know, that's a lot more than I get on my savings. I'm helping my club move forward. You know, maybe there is a chance that the club will be promoted, and, you know, I think the risk of losing my money is not that high.
Exactly.
So why not do that?
Fausto, how sensitive to any kind of potential decline in the economic situation are these football clubs, because they do rely on funding, they do rely on being able to access capital, and obviously Roger and I were talking before you came on air about the impact of the coronavirus, likely impact on the global economy. Does that worry you as a financier of sports, particularly with all the cancellations that we're getting, the potential loss of revenues?
It's
hard to be sympathetic to governments bailing out football clubs, for example.
I think there will be definitely, I mean, it depends on what will happen, but assuming a scenario where the competition is shut and the games are not going to be replayed in the near future, I think there will be a number of clubs in Italy that will have cash flow problems. And because, you know, the cost base is fixed, and, you know, kind of, you know, not having the match day revenues will flow straight to the bottom line. And, you know, they might, you know, and some of the owners are not that liquid. You know, some of the sponsors might potentially step in, but, you know, in times of crisis, a lot of people are, you know, become very insular. and then so it's not easy to get, you know, people to step up when you need it. So I do think that a number of clubs in Italy, but potentially also in other countries that might be impacted in coming weeks, will have problems. And, you know, every league will need to look at what they can do. You know, perhaps there are prepayments or some broadcasting revenues. Perhaps there are some financing deals that can be done, some type of rescue packages. I mean, I don't know. I'm just, you know, kind of making assumptions, but I do think it will have a real impact on a number of clubs. I mean, if you think about, even a club like Juve, you know, the competition being suspended until April, it was going to have a more than 15 million of impact on their cash flows. I mean, it's a lot of money, even for a big club.
Yeah. Listen, Fausto, just before we wrap up, you mentioned Juve. So let's lighten it up a little bit. Juve Inter tonight. How do you see that going, and what is your prediction for who wins the championship?
Now, Fausto, you can record several answers to this, because this will go out after the match and we can just cut the right one in for you, so you can have a sage.
No, I'll make one prediction. I believe, like, the game behind closed doors should theoretically benefit Inter Milan. I think this is a game that Conte will have prepared in so much detail. So I would go for a 0-1
victory for Inter Milan. And I actually agree with you. I think Inter go into this probably as favourites. But I think if that happens, then Mr. Sarri isn't long for this world, I'm afraid.
that's a little harsh, right? I didn't realise they got quite that upset if they lost.
Yeah, I don't know. He probably would survive till the end of the season for sure. And then, you know, need to see what happens to the musical chairs around Europe, I think. Not winning the Scudetto after 7 years probably is very good for Italian football, but probably for Agnelli is not acceptable. I think it depends on the availability of other coaches as well at that point in time. Plus, you just never know. I mean, paying or losing a lot of money. I'm not 100% sure what Sarri's contract is, but paying a penalty on early termination on that as well might not be very, very attractive.
Well, look, Fausto, it's been a fascinating conversation. We've been looking forward to it for some time, and it's certainly lived up to all our expectations. But before we wrap up, just please let the listeners know where they can follow you, where they can find out more about Tifosi on the internet, social media, etc.
Absolutely. From a website point of view, it's tifosi.com, TIFOSY.com. Can also follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn. And me personally, it's Fausto Zanaton on Twitter.
Fantastic. Fausto, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It's been a real pleasure.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Fausto, that was wonderful. Really an education for so many of us. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Speak soon.
Speak soon, man.
Bye-bye.
Wonderful. That's fascinating, Roger. I mean, it's every time I get a window into your world and the places you come at sport from, it's so eye-opening for me to hear all that.
Well, that isn't really, I mean, this is right at the edges of sport, Grant. This is what I call, you know, the smart guys in the background with their ways of influencing things that fans don't understand. You know, Milan, Roma, Inter, and so many other clubs have used Fausto to finance what they've tried to do. I just thought it was so interesting that the last bit about, you know, the coupon rates at Norwich, you know,
yeah.
Would you take 8% at Fulham now, Grant, if they offered it?
Mate, I'd take a playoff place at Fulham.
Yeah, no, but seriously, let's say they came out.
No, you're absolutely right. Listen, you're absolutely right, particularly when you build in things like promotion bonuses and that sort of thing. It's such a great way to structure debt issuance to true investors. I mean, you know, the fans are invested in the club in every way possible, bar financially for a lot of them, right? Which is for them, it's the simplest decision in the world to make. You know, do I support the club with my money? Yeah, every week, and with the shirt I buy for my kids and the travel and everything else. Do I want to support them financially and have a stake in the future and also an interest that's more than emotional in getting promotion? Absolutely. I mean, I'm surprised it's taken this long to get this kind of instrument up and running, Roger, to be honest with you.
Well, I'm surprised that it hasn't got his door getting banged down to for people, because it's just very, very interesting. And, you know, he's seen both ends of the market. He's got the crowdfunding end that we've just talked about, together with, the big money end that you can do so many things about around securitization and everything like that. You know, he's in control of both ends of the market. And you can tell that, you know, he knows the sport. Just so fascinating that, you know, Sampdoria, you know, the owner of Sampdoria, Ferrero, is a totally eccentric kind of guy. And I know that he was offered a magnificent deal with great investors, with Vialli, with historical Genovese families that would have given it all the branding and credibility it needed, and he still didn't take the deal. That happens a lot in Italy, and, you know, football is still in this world that they just haven't woken up and smelt the coffee yet, mate, and one day it's going to be one hell of a cold shower.
Yeah, but look, I think these in Italy, particularly the clubs, are assets, Roger, that have stayed in families for generations. But at some point, that asset is going to be up on the chopping block because a generation is going to come along, as always happens, that isn't as invested emotionally as their great great grandfather or the grandfather or the father was, and it will, and that'll be the time for guys like Fausto to take these things to the next level and do something with them that isn't doable with an eccentric owner, unfortunately.
Yeah. So anybody at clubs listening to this, I would suggest that you look at his website and see what he can do for you, because so many clubs are cash poor, as he said, as we know, and that's a solution that works and has been proven to work, and you should definitely look into it.
Absolutely. Well, look, Roger, the end of another fascinating conversation, and the end of another week. I think producer James is going to try and get this one turned around and out a little quicker this week because of everything that's going on. But all that remains is for us to thank you for listening. To remind you, please, to share, rate and review the podcast. That would be fantastic. And follow us on Twitter if you're not already. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word, A-R-E. And you can follow me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake, for the next month at least.
Yeah.
Rog, as always, thank you, mate.
Good one.
And we'll talk
great
to you
one.
Soon.
Take care.